Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
DC politicians want to enact harmful credit card mandates that could take away your cash back and rewards points, perks that stretch your budget and make life a little easier. Losing these benefits means less money for your family's everyday essentials like gas and groceries. The perks you rely on could disappear, leaving you with higher costs and fewer options. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.
Okay, let's unpack this. For years, the name Jeffrey Epstein has conjured up, you know, all these images of deep secrecy, illicit connections, powerful people who seem to operate completely above the law.
Mm-hmm.
We've heard the rumors, we've heard the allegations, the denials. But recently, we got a glimpse, maybe the clearest glimpse yet, into Epstein's own thinking about all those connections.
Yeah, and that glimpse came from just a massive trove of documents. We're talking over 20,000 pages that were released by the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee.
And that's a really important distinction we need to make right at the top, because I think there's a lot of confusion out there. These are not the full DOJ files everyone talks about.
Exactly. These specific files were obtained after the committee subpoenaed the Epstein estate itself.
So this is his stuff.
This is his stuff. It's his private correspondence, emails, text messages, mostly from around 2011 to 2019. It's essentially his digital locker in the years leading up to his final arrest and his death.
So what we're seeing is his internal political calculations, his grudges, his attempts to manipulate public opinion.
Precisely. And that's the framework you, as the listener, have to use here. This is not a court finding facts. This is the private claims, the opinions, the boasts, and the, you know, deeply manipulative communications of a convicted sex offender.
So if Epstein says he has dirt on someone, that's just a claim.
It is just a claim from a deeply unreliable narrator who is trying to build leverage or control a narrative. We have to be so careful with that distinction.
Right. And our mission today is to do a deep dive into the most important nuggets we can pull from these files, focusing on the communications involving Epstein and these, you know, high-profile figures in politics, media, royalty.
And right away, one thing just jumps off the page when you look at the analysis from places like NPR.
The sheer volume of references to Donald Trump.
An incredible volume. Over 1,000 mentions just in the pages that they reviewed. It's a huge concentration on one single person.
So what does that tell us?
Well, I think it tells us two things. First, it shows you who was under the most intense media scrutiny during that 2015 to 2019 window.
Right, the campaign and the first term.
And second, it shows Epstein's clear, almost obsessive interest in either leveraging, attacking, or just, you know, fixating on that relationship once Trump became a serious political candidate.
Yeah.
We really have to explore how he positioned himself during that time.
As an insider with all the secrets.
As the man who knew everything.
Okay, so let's start there with that central conflict. This relationship between Trump and Epstein. Most of the exchanges we see about Trump are from 2015 to 2018.
The timing is not an accident.
No. Suddenly, this old relationship, this old friendship, has massive political relevance.
And so the reporters immediately came sniffing around. And this leads us directly to some of the most sensational claims in these documents, claims that seem, you know, almost designed to confirm everyone's worst suspicions.
And we can start with this really shocking photo offer from December 2015. The exchange starts with Landon Thomas Jr., who was a former reporter for The New York Times. And he reaches out to Epstein, basically saying, hey, people are looking for juicy info on you and Trump.
And he specifically cites that old, now infamous, 2002 New York Magazine article.
That's the one that's kind of the ghost in this whole narrative,
right? It really is. That's where Trump is quoted calling Epstein a terrific guy who likes beautiful women as much as I do, and many of them are on the younger side.
And once Trump declares he's running for president, that quote becomes, I mean, a massive political liability.
A huge one. And it guaranteed that reporters would be circling back to Epstein for more.
So Thomas tells Epstein, hey, everyone's hunting for dirt on you because of this quote. Mm-hmm. And Epstein, instead of, you know, downplaying it or denying it, he just immediately escalates.
He escalates in a huge way. He sends back this email, and it's full of typos, by the way, which makes it feel even more raw.
What did it say?
He wrote, would you like photso, P-H-O-T-S-O, of Donald and girls in bikinis in my kitchen?
Wow. Just offers it up.
It's just like that. And Thomas's reply is just as revealing. He writes back, yes, with 2 exclamation points.
Which perfectly captures the, you know, the feverish demand for any kind of scandal at that time.
It really does. But we have to pause on what Epstein is implying there. He's not just claiming to know some embarrassing gossip.
No, he's claiming to have physical evidence, photographs.
Exactly. Evidence that would connect Trump directly to an environment that's now infamous,
yeah.
An environment associated with abuse. That elevates the claim from just a rumor to, you know, alleged documented leverage.
But, and this is the critical piece we have to keep coming back to, we have no evidence that he actually had these photos.
None.
We have the claim, we have the offer, we have the reporter's eagerness, but the photos themselves, they're not in these documents.
And that's his whole strategy, isn't it? It's the strategic deployment of a threat, whether the ammunition is real or not. He knew how to use suggestion to maintain this aura of power.
And he wasn't done. He keeps going with these anecdotal smears. Mm. He then tells Thomas about this bizarre glass door incident.
Right, this is a weird one. He suggests Thomas should, quote, ask my houseman about Don and DOD. Almost walking through the door, leaving his nose print on the glass as young women were swimming in the pool, and he was so focused, he walked straight into the door.
Okay, so why that specific story? It's so visual, it's almost comedic.
It is, but its function is deadly serious. It's designed to paint a picture of a man so obsessed, so distracted by young women, that he literally loses awareness of his physical surroundings.
He's trying to link Trump to the atmosphere of his whole operation.
Suggesting shared predilections, shared behavior. And again, we have no context on when or where this might have happened. It's just an anecdote floated to a reporter.
And this continues with claims about them sharing romantic partners, which seems designed to weave this history of mutual, you know, inappropriate behavior.
Yeah, he sent Thomas a link to a feature story about a woman and claimed, my 20-year-old girlfriend in 93 Harrow, that after 2 years, I gave to Donald.
Gave to Donald. I mean, the language itself is just...
It suggests a commodification, a sharing of partners that is just deeply, deeply corrosive. His strategy is becoming crystal clear here.
Which is what?
Establish proximity and mutual transgression. Basically, if I'm tainted, then you are too. If I go down, you should at least be damaged by the association.
This pattern then leads us into a much darker category of claim. This is where Epstein starts to suggest that Trump had direct knowledge of the illegal activities.
Right, and he uses this very famous Sherlock Holmes reference to do it, the dog that hasn't barked.
Which is a powerful way of putting it. It suggests that the absence of something is actually the evidence.
It implies a deliberate concealment. And this happened way back in a 2011 email exchange with Ghislaine Maxwell, long before Trump was a serious presidential candidate.
And what did he say?
He wrote, I want you to realize that that dog that hasn't barked is Trump.
And his reasoning for why Trump's silence was so suspicious.
It centered on a victim. He claimed that this specific victim, who the White House later identified as Virginia Giuffre, spent hours at my house with him. He has never once been mentioned.
That is a profoundly insidious accusation. He's placing Trump at the scene, implying he should have been caught up in the investigations, but somehow wasn't.
He's planting the seed of a high-level cover-up, or at least special treatment.
And this implication of knowledge, it just gets less and less ambiguous as time goes on.
Oh, much less. By 2019, in an email to the journalist Michael Wolff, he states it much more plainly. He's talking about the girls, and he says, of course he knew about the girls, as he asked Ghislaine to stop.
So that's not just awareness. That's claiming Trump actively intervened.
It essentially turns Trump into a direct witness to the alleged crimes. It's a massive escalation of the claim.
But this is where the nuance of the source material is so, so important, because we have these potentially devastating claims from Epstein on one side.
And on the other, we have crucial contextual checks and official denials.
Right. We cannot just read Epstein's claims in a vacuum. The White House said the redacted victim Epstein referred to in that 2011 email was Virginia Giuffre.
And this is the key point for anyone listening. Virginia Giuffre, who has accused many, many powerful men of wrongdoing, has never accused Donald Trump of any wrongdoing.
So you have Epstein, the alleged co-conspirator, claiming Trump knew everything. And you have the victim herself saying Trump did nothing wrong to her.
That discrepancy is fundamental. It completely challenges Epstein's reliability as a narrator here.
So what was he doing? Was he just strategically lying? Was he misrepresenting the facts to gain leverage, knowing full well the victim wouldn't back up his story?
I think that's the central question these documents force us to ask. It really suggests that Epstein was deploying claims that were strategically unprovable, or maybe even easily refutable if you dug deep enough, but were politically devastating on the surface.
The accusation itself is the weapon.
Exactly. The accusation is the weapon, regardless of its factual basis. His own credibility is shot, but the political taint remains. It's a classic smear.
So beyond all the sleaze and the gossip, these documents also show Epstein was actively trying to engage in the political maneuvering around Trump. He was positioning himself as this, you know, either very useful or very dangerous source for journalists and political rivals.
Absolutely. And his relationship with the author Michael Wolff is just a fascinating window into this. Wolff was writing his big book on Trump at the time.
Fire and Fury.
That's the one. And you see this alignment of interests. Wolff needs dirt, and Epstein needs to shape the narrative, either for his own protection or maybe for revenge.
And Wolff was definitely encouraging him to speak out. He frames it as Epstein being this necessary voice against the, you know, the rising tide of Trumpism.
He does. Early on, this is February 2016, he tells Epstein that Hillary Clinton's campaign and other reporters are digging deeply on the Trump relationship. And then he suggests Epstein should consider preempting.
So he's basically coaching him on media strategy. Get ahead of the story before it buries you.
It's a journalist actively urging a source to manage the disclosure timeline, to get out in front of what would likely be very hostile coverage. But that encouragement, it becomes something much more later in the year.
It becomes outright political advocacy.
Completely. And it shows you just how high the stakes were. This is the October 2016 exchange right after the Access Hollywood tapes dropped.
A huge moment in that campaign.
A massive moment. And Wolff sees this as a clear opportunity. The subject line of his email is direct, and he explicitly proposes that Epstein should come forward this week and talk about Trump in such a way that could garner you great sympathy and help finish him. Interested.
Help finish him. I mean, that goes so far beyond just sourcing information.
Oh, way beyond. It's a direct invitation to join a political attack squad. It just highlights the belief among Trump's opponents and many in the media that Epstein possessed some kind of silver bullet. Information that, if he deployed it in the right way, could genuinely end Trump's campaign.
Which explains why this political motivation seems to fuel some of Epstein's most scathing personal criticisms of Trump. He clearly developed a deep loathing for the man he once called a friend.
You really see that in his communications with Katherine Rumler, who was the former White House counsel for President Obama.
That's a critical link, right? It shows Epstein still had this deep, high-level access to bipartisan political power players.
It does. So in 2017, Rumler calls Trump so gross in a message to Epstein. And Epstein replies immediately with this air of insider conviction, worse in real life and up close.
So he's not just agreeing, he's one-upping her. He's claiming to have this superior intimate knowledge of just how bad Trump's character is.
And he articulates that even more strongly in another 2017 exchange, this time with Larry Summers, the former Treasury Secretary under Clinton.
Another big name.
A very big name. And he lays out this really stark moral condemnation of Trump. He writes, "Recall, I've told you, I have met some very bad people in that stone yard, none as bad as Trump. Not one decent cell in his body. So yes, dangerous."
Wow. He also called him a maniac, showing signs of early dementia and other messages.
He did. This complete pivot from, you know, friendly association to just absolute venom is so striking. And it probably suggests a huge falling out, likely fueled by Trump's political rise and the need for both men to publicly distance themselves from each other.
But the attacks weren't just these personal character assassinations. They moved into what Epstein clearly thought was his real leverage: financial dirt, business fraud.
Yes. And this becomes especially clear after Michael Cohen, Trump's former fixer, pleads guilty.
That's when Epstein seems to be trying to signal, hey, I have the real stuff, not just gossip.
Exactly. He writes to Rumler, "You see, I know how dirty Donald is. And my guess is that non-lawyers, nitty-biz people have no idea what it means to have your fixer flip." He's signaling that the real scandal is financial, and it's hidden from everyone except the kind of New York business elite that he moved in.
And did he get specific? What was the financial criticism he was leveling at Trump's business model?
He did. And this is where it moves beyond gossip into something much more technical, something approaching alleged accounting fraud.
Oh, okay.
In a 2019 email to Wolf, he criticizes the whole methodology of Trump's financial statements. He claims Trump lists the gross receipts of his clubs.
Mm-hmm.
He uses Doral as an example, a property that was allegedly losing money.
So he's listing all the money coming in, not the profit.
Exactly. He's listing the gross revenue as his income, not his net personal revenue after expenses. He also claimed Trump gets huge fees just for slapping his name on developments. He called the whole practice amazing, implying this level of, you know, creative accounting that only a true insider could appreciate.
So this is a crucial point. It shows Epstein believed his real power wasn't in some unverified photos, but in verifiable financial knowledge that could actually trigger investigations or completely collapse Trump's business legitimacy.
Absolutely. He was positioning himself as the key witness to the inner mechanics of Trump's finances. And all of this narrative construction, all of this positioning, it all builds toward this one singular striking declaration of power he makes in late 2018.
The famous text message.
The one that really just encapsulates his entire strategy of perceived leverage. In December of 2018, some unknown person texts Epstein and suggests that the investigations that were going on, presumably into Epstein himself, were really just trying to take down Trump.
And Epstein's reply, what, 6 months before his own arrest, is just chillingly confident.
It really is. He writes back, yes, the OSCs.
Mm-hmm.
It's wild.
Mm-hmm.
Because I am the one able to take him down.
I am the one able to take him down.
It's the ultimate statement.
Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
...of self-importance. It's him claiming he holds a political kill switch over sitting president of the United States. But the profound irony, as we've been discussing, is that these documents prove he claimed to have that power, but they don't contain the actual evidence itself.
And just quickly, before we move on, there's that one small but very telling detail about the Mar-a-Lago membership.
Yes.
Trump has often claimed that he was the one who cut ties with Epstein, that he stripped him of his membership for being a creep.
Right, and Epstein directly contradicted that story. He was trying to suggest Trump was being disingenuous. He wrote to Wolf, "Trump said he asked me to resign, never a member ever."
It's such a petty detail in the grand scheme of things.
It is, but it perfectly reflects the larger narrative war that was going on.
Yeah.
You have these two former associates, both of them completely discredited in their own ways, actively contradicting each other to try and control their own histories and their public images.
Okay, so we've focused heavily on Trump, and that's because of the sheer volume of references. But these files also give us some really crucial insight into Epstein's communications about Bill Clinton and Prince Andrew.
Mm. And this section is so vital because it reveals the different strategic calculations Epstein was making. You see who he protected and who he was, let's say, a little more flippant about. And the contrast is really fascinating, isn't it? Because while he's trashing Trump to anyone who will listen, he adopts this surprisingly consistent, almost defensive posture when it comes to Bill Clinton.
A very defensive posture, particularly around the most damaging allegations, the ones connected to his private island.
Right. Epstein consistently and forcefully denied that Clinton had ever been to Little St. James, the island where so much of the abuse took place. Why would he be so protective there?
Well, it could just be simple legal self-preservation. I mean, think about it. If a former president of the United States were definitively tied to the activities on that island, the resulting investigation would have been exponentially larger, exponentially more dangerous for Epstein himself.
So defending Clinton was really an act of defending himself.
It could be seen as a kind of legal hygiene, yeah.
Mm.
keeping the investigation focused away from the absolute highest strata of political power.
And he was very forceful about it. He wrote to Landon Thomas Jr. in 2015 that a victim's claim about a dinner with Clinton on the island was completely made up. And his quote was, "Clinton was never, ever there. Never."
That's a categorical denial.
Yeah.
It's a totally different tone from the strategic ambiguity and the innuendo he used when he was talking about Trump.
He even told Michael Wolff he had a former girlfriend who could refute claims about Clinton and the former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak being on the island. He was actively trying to construct a counter-narrative to defend Clinton.
And we also see that his connections to Clinton's orbit were still current, which suggests his high-level networking was just ongoing, even after his 2008 conviction.
He mentions that an immunologist, Boris Nikolic, who worked for Bill Gates, had recently met with Clinton.
Yeah, the networking never stopped, which indicates that, you know, powerful people, or at least people adjacent to power, were still in his professional circle.
Okay, so now let's pivot to Prince Andrew. In the emails, he's identified as the Duke.
Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, yes.
And unlike with Clinton, where Epstein is playing defense, the emails show Andrew was actively engaged in crisis management with Epstein.
And this goes all the way back to 2011. It's a completely different dynamic.
It feels almost like a client relationship. Andrew is relying on Epstein for immediate legal and PR advice after the Mail on Sunday newspaper comes asking for a comment about Virginia Giuffre's claims.
And Andrew is clearly in a state of total panic. His reply to Epstein is just desperate and it's demanding. He says, "Please make sure that every statement or legal letter states clearly that I am not involved and that I knew and know nothing about any of these allegations. I can't take any more of this my end."
It's just a profound look at a royal who's caught in a massive scandal and he's turning for help to the very person at the center of that scandal.
Incredible. And Epstein's own reaction to that press inquiry, which he then forwarded to Andrew, is just breathtakingly cynical.
What did he say?
He wrote, I'm not sure how to respond. The only person she didn't have sex with was Elvis." That flippancy, it just shows his complete and utter detachment from the human cost of any of these allegations. It reinforces his view of the world as just a game of influence and media manipulation.
And he wasn't just flippant. He was actively trying to discredit Giuffre. He suggested to a publicist back in 2011 that she could easily be proven to be a liar and that Buckingham Palace would love it if someone investigated her.
So he's directly attempting to use his network to destroy a victim's credibility. It's a strategy we see continue.
Right, because we see the PR strategy laid out even more clearly in a 2015 exchange with that same reporter, Landon Thomas Jr.
Yes. Thomas advises Epstein, "I think the big issue is separating yourself from Andrew." But then he suggests how Andrew's specific situation could be sort of downplayed.
How so?
He suggests framing it this way. Andrew had consensual sex with, redacted.
Yeah.
And redacted worked for you. The rest is atmospherics.
Okay, wait, let's unpack that. That is a media strategy in real time. Thomas is suggesting they should shift the focus away from any criminal activity, away from trafficking, and reframe it as just an inappropriate but legal relationship between a royal and an adult who happened to work for Epstein.
Exactly. It's a strategy of minimization. Reduce the offense from potential involvement in a trafficking ring to just, you know, bad optics involving a consensual affair. The goal was to shield Andrew from the really grave accusations.
The communication is just such a raw look at how these media narratives get manufactured behind the scenes during a crisis.
It really is. And despite all this legal jeopardy, Epstein seemed to have this strange personal affection for Andrew. He described him as great fun in another exchange.
It just shows the complexity of these relationships. They were functional, tactical, and sometimes superficially affectionate, even while they were steeped in profound legal danger.
And I think the big takeaway from this section is seeing Epstein's web of influence and how he managed it. He attacked the man he saw as a political enemy, which was Trump. He defended the man he saw as a potential legal liability, Clinton. And he acted as a crisis manager for the royal, who was already caught in the dragnet, Prince Andrew.
Three powerful men, three completely different strategies.
Precisely.
So the moment these House oversight documents drop, the political world has to respond. And given how focused the claims were on Trump, whether they were verified or not, the fallout was immediate and, you know, predictably highly partisan.
Oh, absolutely. The response was a masterclass in narrative control designed to just preempt any potential damage before it could even set in.
The White House, Trump's allies, they immediately went into total denial and deflection mode.
And they focused on the messenger, not the message.
Right. The White House press secretary, Caroline Leavitt, she stated, just categorically, that the emails prove absolutely nothing other than the fact that President Trump did nothing wrong.
And then she instantly framed the whole release as a partisan hit job. She accused Democrats of using selectively leaked emails to the liberal media to create a fake narrative.
That's the first line of defense, right? Discredit the sources, frame the whole thing as a political maneuver.
It is. And then Trump himself follows the same script. He declares the whole disclosure a hoax and explicitly blames Democrats for trying to distract the public from, what was it, the end of the government shutdown at the time.
So the establishment defense was completely unified. Nothing to see here, folks. This is just dirty politics.
And you even saw that filtration happen in the conservative media sphere. Sean Hannity at Fox News was reported to have essentially just dismissed the story, suggesting the emails only showed that Epstein had a personal grudge against Trump, not that Trump had done anything wrong.
The unified message from the right was clear. Epstein is an unreliable, vengeful narrator, and the Democrats are desperate.
But what's really, truly fascinating to me is the reaction from the far-right conspiracy crowd.
The very same group that has historically been the loudest voice demanding the release of all the Epstein files to expose this so-called deep state.
Exactly. And their reaction was, as it was put, uncharacteristically dismissive.
And that's the profound contradiction here, isn't it? These are the people who have built entire online universes on claims with far less substantiation than this.
And yet, when documentation that explicitly targets Trump is released by a congressional committee, the reaction isn't outrage. It's this very calculated skepticism.
It really reveals the strategic nature of their demands for transparency.
It does. I mean, Alex Jones, who's a figurehead for so much of this, he claimed it just shows there's nothing there. And then asserted that Trump was innocent and was actually the first person to expose Epstein.
Which just completely ignores the substance of what Epstein was claiming about the photos or the shared girlfriend.
Ignores it completely.
Yeah.
And then you have Jack Posobiec, a former Pizzagate theorist, and he pivots the entire narrative. He suggests the emails were just Epstein trying to pull Trump in and implicate him in his own crimes.
That is political jujitsu.
It really is. They transformed what could be seen as evidence against their preferred candidate into proof of his persecution.
So the prevailing narrative they adopted was that these are drip-drip Democrat disclosures and distractions being used to smear a good man's name.
It's an incredibly effective way to inoculate their base against the actual contents of the documents.
And instead of accepting these documents as the transparency that they supposedly wanted, they used the release to reinforce their narrative that Trump is under attack.
And they concluded that the real criminals must be hiding in the files that are still unreleased. So they continue to demand the release of the entire archive, blaming billionaires and donors for blocking it.
It's a perfect example of shifting the goalposts. Transparency is only good when it targets your opponents.
But this manufactured demand for the full release, it does lead us directly to the separate and much more serious legislative battle that's happening at the same time in Congress.
And this is where we have to, once again, reinforce that distinction for you, the listener. The release we've been talking about came from the House Oversight Committee subpoenaing the estate. This legislative push is totally separate.
This is the big one. This is for the full release of all the unclassified files held by the Justice Department.
And that fight has reached a really critical stage. It involves something called a discharge petition,
which is a rare and very powerful tool in Congress. It's used to force a floor vote on a bill when the House leadership is trying to block it.
And this petition, for the bill to release the full DOJ files, it recently got the 218 signatures it needed, which guarantees a floor vote is coming soon.
And what's so significant about those signatures is that they included four Republicans who are normally very staunch Trump allies.
Yancey Mace, Lauren Boebert, Thomas Massie, and Marjorie Taylor Greene.
And their support for this just underscores how deep the public anger over the Epstein scandal runs. It's an issue that transcends the typical partisan lines, but it also highlights the internal tension within the Republican Party.
And the source material shows there was intense political pressure put on those four immediately to get them to withdraw their support.
Oh, yeah. There were reports of White House attempts involving people like Pam Bondi and FBI Director Kash Patel trying to persuade Boebert and Mace to pull their names off the petition.
And it didn't work.
It failed. Nancy Mace, for instance, she's spoken publicly about being a survivor of sexual abuse, and she publicly recommitted to the petition. She said the issue was deeply personal for her.
But at the same time, she was defending Trump against what she called the media noise, saying she would defend every last attack on President Trump to the death.
And that balancing act just perfectly encapsulates the political dilemma they're in.
Right.
They have to support transparency on the Epstein issue, which is incredibly popular with the base, while simultaneously managing their political loyalty to the leader of their party.
It shows that for some of these lawmakers, the issue of justice for Epstein's victims is a moral imperative that they just can't afford to ignore politically, no matter whose name might end up in the documents.
And the crucial difference between the House oversight release we've been discussing and this potential DOJ release is what's in them. The DOJ files would contain material gathered by federal investigators, not just Epstein's private, self-serving emails.
That is a much higher stakes gamble for every single person who is ever involved in this saga.
A much, much higher stakes gamble.
So we have covered just a vast, complex web of information here, from Epstein claiming he had photos of a future president in, you know, compromising situations, to his detailed financial criticisms, to his varied strategies for protecting some powerful men and attacking others.
And I think if we synthesize the key takeaways, it really is the dual nature of these emails that defines this whole deep dive. On one hand, you have these sensational, politically damaging claims.
Epstein offering photos, suggesting Trump knew about the girls, leveling these strong political attacks.
But on the other hand, every single one of those claims is being made by a completely unreliable narrator. They're contradicted by key people, like Virginia Giuffre in Trump's case, and ultimately they remain unverified by the documents themselves.
And the most powerful summation of Epstein's own perceived power is that 2018 text message, where he just chillingly states, "I am the one able to take him down." He genuinely believed he held the ultimate weapon.
And what's so fascinating is that Epstein saw himself as holding this ultimate political weapon, yet when these particular documents are finally released, the entire political establishment, both the White House and the far-right conspiracy world, they've been so quick and so effective at controlling the narrative.
Right, framing it as either a partisan attack or a total nothing burger.
Exactly. The focus immediately shifted from what Epstein claimed to why these documents were being released now.
So this really raises an important question for you, the listener, to think about as this whole drama continues to unfold. The documents we've talked about today from the House Oversight Committee, they're only a fraction of the total records the Justice Department holds.
And that legislative push for the full DOJ archive is about to come to a head.
So, considering the intense political pressure, the split reaction we've seen from the White House calling it a hoax to the far right using it to demand more transparency, what impact will the impending congressional vote to release the entire DOJ archive have on the public narrative, regardless of what information it ultimately contains?
Because the discussion so far has really been about Jeffrey Epstein's self-serving and tactical claims, the next step, the full DOJ release, that could potentially shift the entire focus to the federal government's institutional knowledge of this case and its handling of this case over decades.
And that is a fundamentally different conversation.
A very different conversation. It moves the target from the powerful figures that Epstein knew to the powerful officials who might have protected them.
And that's our deep dive for today.
DC politicians want to enact harmful credit card mandates that could take away your cash back and rewards points. Perks that stretch your budget and make life a little easier. Losing these benefits means less money for your family's everyday essentials like gas and groceries. The perks you rely on could disappear, leaving you with higher costs and fewer options. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.